This is Out of School, the podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, joined by Bradley Chambers, as always. I forgot to check who the sponsor was. Let's start that again. Right. It's just Jamf again?
Yes.
All right. I thought it might be near high for some reason. Okay, let's go again. This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have one sponsor for the show, our good friends at Jamf Software again, and we'll talk to you a little bit later about the Casper Suite, which is their mobile device management system for Macs and iPads, and iPhones, of course. And I'll tell you a little bit about their product, Casper Focus. So we'll get to that later on in the show. Bradley, how are you?
Fantastic. How about you?
Okay. I'm not too bad. Surviving. So this is actually a double header show. Just so people know, this show is being recorded whatever day it is today, 9th of October. So we've recorded a couple on the same day because of some travel schedules that are coming up. So if we see anything that gets obsoleted within the next 7 days, then we apologize in advance, but we'll do our best to be evergreen. So what's on the ticket for tonight?
I think we're going to talk about and do some listener feedback that's been building up and talk about the, supposed iPad event.
Yeah, so we're a little ahead of the actual official Apple announcement as we speak. Just yesterday, I think it was late yesterday, the news was broken, I think in All Things D, that there's going to be an Apple event 22nd of October, at which the report said that, help me remember what they said, Bradley, I think it was there's going to be an iPad 5. They're saying also that there's going to be an iPad mini with a Retina display and an yes. A7 chip in the mini, as well as presumably in the big iPad as well. So that's the claim. And at least the date was given a yep by Jim Dalrymple on The Loop. So that means it's, of course, correct and true. And I guess the question is, what else? Or what else could happen? You know, I think the A7's a given, at least in the big iPad. I'm not so sure about the smaller one, but we'll see. What do you think?
I could see that staying with an A6. I could see it staying with kind of the previous generation processor, mainly due to battery life. You know, as we mentioned in the previous show, that's kind of Apple's MO is protecting battery life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if the A7, of course, they got an A7 into a phone, so I guess, you know, I guess it's, everything's possible. But it just all depends on what it takes to power that size Retina. If it's a Retina, you know, what it takes to power that versus how much room is left for a battery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thing that is always in the phone's favor is that even though it's Retina and has been for years, it's not as big a screen and it doesn't have as many pixels as one of the iPad-sized screens. So it'll be interesting to see just what happens with that. I kind of get the sense that, you know, if you think that the top of the line iOS hardware that can be built is an A7 processor and a Retina display, and they can't do anything better than that for now, then how do you differentiate the small iPad from the big one? Is it just purely size, or is there something else? So I think from a kind of segmentation point of view, that I think probably A6 in the mini, or A6X with a Retina display, and A7 on the full size iPad, just to give people a reason to spend, you know, $600-$800 on a big one, possibly a bit more. So I'm kind of leaning towards there being some processor difference between the two, but I don't think it will be as big as keeping the mini on the A5 and putting the big one on the A7. I think the A5 has got to go at this point, is kind of my sense.
Yeah, it's the A5's really dragging on the old product line. I think you said that earlier. It's just compare it when you see how the A7 works, and the A5 feels slow. I mean, it's a couple years old. iPad 2 have that?
Yeah, the A5 non-X variant was the iPad 2 processor. So except in terms of radios and cameras, the iPad mini as currently sold is essentially an iPad 2 in a smaller box. And I mean, it's a fine product, don't get me wrong, but I guess my concern has been that, you know, having the A5 being sold today as a current product and obviously having to have a lifespan after that, then is that holding back the possibility that developers could build more and better devices or more and better applications? if the devices moved on to A6, A7 class processors sooner. So I'm thinking that getting rid of the A5 would be probably one of the best things to happen in this round. And of course, we've just got A6X based iPads in school here, and they are fast. I mean, they are very fast. Have you had a chance to play with an iPhone 5S yet?
Yes, and you can, even compared to my 5, like, I can tell a difference.
Yeah, so could I. I had a go with it. I was in Chicago for SecondCon a couple of weeks ago. I just had a play with it in the Apple Store on Michigan Avenue, and it was my test was to take all the videos I could find on the phone, concatenate them all into one big long movie, and then export it from iMovie on the phone. And that was noticeably fast. And I think, to me, that's one of the kind of benchmark tests, if you like, that I use to look at the performance of an iOS device is how fast can you render some video, either from iMovie or from Explain Everything or something like that. Because that's something that we kind of run into a lot now that we're doing more with video, is that certainly an A5-based iPad, whether mine or other teachers, is pretty slow when it comes to exporting something out of iMovie, for example. And the A6 ones that the kids have got are noticeably faster again, and then the A7 in the phone is faster yet again. So I think performance still matters on iOS. Is I think what I've kind of been saying to people for a while is that I think there's certainly more that can be done on iOS, and I think more performance out of the device while keeping the battery life the same is still important. I don't think we're at a stage right now where we could say, well, that's all the performance we ever need from an iPad, because I think there's still a lot more we could do with it.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I don't see the A5 living on in the second generation iPad mini. My fear, all right, let me ask you this. Do you think the iPad 2 and the iPad mini live on through this generation?
That's a good question. iPad 2, I think not. I think the iPad 2's got to go. And I think it will go in favor of some variant of the iPad mini. To me, it's an open question whether the current version of the iPad mini lives on. That's a possibility, I think, because although it's not super fast, it does at least have good cameras and modern radios that support things like AirDrop, for example. And of course, LTE and the LTE version as well. So I think there's a better chance that the iPad mini lives on in its current form with another one alongside it. But I think the iPad 2 has got to go. It's just, it's an old design. The cameras are terrible. The radios don't support key features like AirDrop. And I think I would like to see that one go sooner rather than later.
I'm wondering how they structure the mini lineup. Is it the iPad mini 1 and the iPad mini, or is it the iPad mini and the iPad mini Retina? I mean, how do they, you know, what happens to the pricing? Does it go down to $249 versus $329? How do they, you know, and again, if that iPad mini lives on, you still have to support that, you know, that A5 processor.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I mean, is it possible that you put an A6 in the baseline mini and put an A6X in a Retina mini? I mean, they're, you know, from a CPU performance point of view, they're not very different, but at least one's got the graphics power for a Retina display. But I think what I would like to see Apple do is I would like to see them be more aggressive with the entry price point, even if that's not necessarily the one that people would buy if they were well advised. But I think, you know, what people are starting to look at very closely is what's the smallest possible price you can pay for a tablet. And, you know, people are looking at, I mean, in the last show I mentioned the Tesco Huddle tablet, which starts at £119. Okay, and that's a 16 gigabyte memory multi-core Android tablet for £119. 7 inches, yes, physically smaller than the iPad mini. But, and maybe that's not the one people buy, but they look at, there's a tablet for £120 and the iPad is £269 for the very, very cheapest one you can get. So I think from a marketing point of view, it would be good to at least have something cheaper, even if everybody ends up buying the Retina one. You know, it's a sort of iPod Shuffle kind of story. And of course, Apple did a great job over a decade of making sure there was an iPod for basically any amount of money you wanted to spend. And I think it would be good to see the iPad start to cover more of those bases further down, even if it has to be a little bit older. I mean, one possibility that I thought about was what if the existing iPad mini gets a kind of iPhone 5C type of case, you know, a coloured case, plastic, very attractive to kids and parents perhaps, as well as being a little bit cheaper and so on as well.
That's a possibility. I mean, I really thought the 5C is going to sell a ton. And if they could get the, even if it was $279, so if you have a $279 and a $329, I think they'd sell a ton of it. Mm-hmm. And they'd still sell a ton of the $329 one, and they are starting to, cover more of those kind of, price points. I don't see them going to $249, but I could see $279. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there's still a lot of compelling things to justify you even buying into iPad at the entry level. I mean, I think there are some people who are saying that there's some evidence that people who went cheap on their first tablet want to spend more on their second one because they sort of regret having been so cheap on the first tablet. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens as well. And one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit, Bradley, was, I don't know if you get this, but I get this all the time, that, whenever you come up to a new iOS event, everybody's saying, well, I can't think of anything that Apple could put into the new device. I mean, what could possibly be new? And I think to some extent, the fact that these are kind of black rectangles of glass leads people to think that they're just, the design is already complete. But I have a few ideas that I thought we might explore together first before we talk about some listener feedback as well. Do you want to hear my list?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm thinking specifically for the full-size iPad. We've talked a little bit about what could happen with the mini, but I'm thinking about the full-size iPad here. And the first thing I think that would be very interesting is if they dropped the 16-gigabyte model. And in those three lower price points for the full-size, that they became 32, 64, and 128 storage levels. So I think one of the things that I see a lot in schools is that people buy the 16. That works for the first 18 months, and then the 16 gig starts to get full. And I think if there's one problem that I have handled more than any other in the past 2 years with iOS devices, it's people running out of storage. And I think we know that they can build a 128 gig iPad. We know they can build all these other sizes as well. I think it would be really nice as one way to kind of justify the higher price point of the bigger device is to say, well, for the entry level, the old 16 gigabyte price, which is £400 in the UK, you now get 32. We're basically doubling the storage at every level. And we obviously already have the 128 gig iPad, so maybe a 256 comes along, or maybe they just go back to three SKUs instead of four for that line. But I think that would be a good move to justify the bigger iPad for the quote-unquote power user, if you like. Do you think that could happen?
16 gigabytes needs to die across the line, in my opinion, but certainly in the full-size iPads. They just got to go away.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly for the serious iOS user, I think 16 is a real pinch. And even for quite casual users, I mean, I'm kind of leaning more towards your point of view, I suppose, that even for people who just like to take some videos, those back cameras are shooting 1080p video now. I mean, that's 1.2 gigabytes every 10 minutes coming off that camera, and that doesn't get a lot of 10 minute videos on a 16 gig iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's number one
for me. And how expensive can 32 be compared to 16? I mean, at some point it's like they're going to run out of 16 gig chips to buy. It's like they'll only, buy the 32 will be all you can buy. It just feels like 16 gigs has hung around way too long.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it being, imagine there is a mini C with a plastic case, then maybe the very, very entry level one is a 16 gig, but you quickly start to get up to bigger sizes quicker as you go up the line. So I think that could be an important factor. I would like to see that happen. I kind of hoped it would happen in the last generation, but I didn't get that, so I've had to pay up for 32 this time. Second thing that has bugged me since forever, basically, with the iPad, is the position of the speaker. And the fact there's only one. So I've put down in my notes here just a better speaker. But I don't know about you, Bradley, but when I watch a video on the iPad, I find myself sort of cupping my hand behind the top right corner as I've got it in landscape, just so that the sound is kind of reflected back towards my ears. rather than shooting backwards out the iPad, which is what happens at the moment. The iPad Mini is much better in that respect. I don't know if you feel that, but I think the iPad Mini speakers are way better than the full-size ones right now.
Oh, absolutely. That iPad Mini speaker is not bad at all.
For such a tiny thing, I think it's phenomenal. So, some kind of better positioning of that. Even if it just shoots out the side, I think it would be better, or the bottom. It would be better than the current arrangement. My next thing is kind of at the other end of the device, which is a better microphone. So one of the things that we've noticed when we started using the fourth generation iPad in school is that kids are loving to shoot video. They're making great videos, but the sound is always terrible. And the microphone slot is, of course, tiny, and it's on the top edge of the device, not on the front or the back. So I would like to see them do something where maybe they put a small microphone on the front for FaceTime and a microphone in the back for videoing, kind of like the iPhone has, because I think a lot of our kids' videos have been great but have been very much let down by the quality of the sound on it. So a better microphone would be very welcome too.
Oh, absolutely. And maybe even like some sort of like external solution from Apple that's meant for the kind of the classroom environments where you could, you know, maybe play some sort of wireless microphone that was airdropping the video back to it. I don't know. Maybe just more thinking out loud there.
Yeah, it's maybe something that Bluetooth could solve. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't love Bluetooth in the classroom just because of the pain in pairing them. But yeah, there's definitely something could be done there. I think also the positioning of it on the device. If you think about shooting a video with an iPad, the way you want to grip the iPad is halfway up both sides. And if you do that, then you are covering the microphone slot on the left-hand side of the case, which obviously leads to handling sounds on the video and muffling the actual proper audio input as well. So I think some repositioning of that would be pretty welcome. I guess based on the phone as well, Bradley, one of the things that I would really like to see is Touch ID on the iPad. I've had a little practice with it with a couple of different phones, and I think it's really, really impressive. It's not everything, but it's better than what we've got at the moment, and I would love to see that on my next iPad for sure.
That would be an interesting addition to a school-wide deployment.
Yeah, that would be interesting and challenging, and I think you would also have some interesting conversations with some parents with that, I think, as well. You know, people are pretty sensitive about, at least in the UK, which is ironic given our general level of surveillance in this country, but people are pretty sensitive about, you know, biometrics being used in schools. And I think possibly, you know, having some way to prevent people setting that up might be something that would calm a lot of nerves in schools as well.
Yeah, I believe that's an option in 1.4 of Configurator, is to disable Touch ID.
Okay, I hadn't seen that, but yeah, that's good thinking ahead of time. My next question is, does the iPad need to have as good a camera as the iPhone? I don't think it ever really has, but is that becoming a thing?
I think it should.
At least the big one, I would argue. I think there's, in some ways, we're trying to think up ways that you could differentiate the big iPad from the little one, and I think having a really good camera in there would be very, very welcome.
I agree. It's even, you know, even a iPad 4, it's just not as good as the iPhone 5. And so I think at this point, technology's matured enough. Let's make sure that differentiating the models, let's make sure that full-size one has as good a camera.
I wonder how expensive the camera is as a component in the phone. I kind of feel like it probably is quite expensive. Because they've always been very, very careful only to put the best camera in the best phone. And everything else that ships with a camera always has like the last generation or the generation before camera from the phone. So I don't know if that's maybe something to kind of protect the phone as being sort of your phone and camera versus the other ones. I'm not sure. But when you see so many people shooting video and photos with iPad now, that, you know, why not put a good camera in at least one of the devices?
I agree.
Yeah. And obviously, one of the reasons I've been kind of suggesting to schools maybe not to think about the iPad 2 is just because the camera is so poor in that device. And when you're in the classroom, when you're indoors, lower light levels, you want the best camera you can get. The iPad 4 camera is good. It's obviously not as good as the 5, certainly not as good as the 5S on the phone, but it's gotten better over the years. But what I would also like to see is please don't make it any higher resolution. I can't handle the amount of data coming off it. I mean, obviously, what's above 1080p? I mean, is it going to be a 4K video camera in the back? Probably not, but I think, you know, one of the things I wish was an iOS 7 that isn't an iOS 7 is some kind of option to shoot lower data rates on the camera. You know, I wish that was something we could turn down a little bit as well, just to save on storage space and file size at times.
Well, that goes back to our discussion on entry level size. You know, 32. You know, I mean, you could even maybe make the argument: could we go to a 64 on the top end model as technology moves along?
Yeah, 64, 128, 256. I mean, that's getting into MacBook Air territory at that point.
I agree. So, the iPad 2, one of those things that still looks good on paper, but again, when you get into the classroom and you see that camera, if you will be using the camera, then it just doesn't hold up as well.
Yeah, it's the difference between having a camera and having a good camera.
Exactly. Having a camera that you can integrate into lesson planning and having a camera that's like, oh, well, that was cool to have.
Yeah, I mean, I think the iPad 2, if I sort of remember rightly, that was kind of the generation of iOS cameras where they were really good for video and terrible for stills. Mm-hmm. The iPod Touch was a wee bit like that for a while, where it had the camera was decent with video and just absolutely sucked for still photography. Better than that today, thankfully. So, yeah, I think more progress on iPad cameras would be a good thing, even if people are still kind of slagging off those who would shoot photographs with an iPad camera. People are doing it. Get over it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. My next one is controversial, and I'd like to know what you think about this one, Bradley, but the next large iPad should have a touchscreen digitizer that is high resolution enough for styluses, or styli, I should say, for precision stylus use. Yes or no?
I could argue both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard something yesterday. What was it on the talk show? And talking about, you know, should we still believe everything that Steve said? Like, was it the car versus truck? And said that doesn't mean that's forever. And so, I don't know. I mean, again, maybe the fact that I could argue either way shows that it's something that we should consider.
Yeah, I mean, it is, in fact, possibly the only thing I have heard people praise about the Microsoft Surface tablets is the fact that their digitizers are higher resolution than those in the iPad, meaning that people can use a stylus with much greater precision for handwriting or for text selection or whatever. And my feeling about it is that, yes, Apple should put in a better digitizer, at least maybe on the high-end models, the full-size models, because I think that size lends itself more to writing on the screen rather than the smaller size. But I also think that I'm not saying that Apple should ship a stylus with the iPad. I absolutely think they should not do that. But what they should do is they should put technology in that enables third parties to ship good styluses, because people clearly want this, right? People absolutely want it. I mean, look at how many you can buy and look at the kind of hoops and the complexity that people are jumping through to get a fine pointed stylus for the iPad, because people really want that. And people are companies are engineering incredibly detailed and intricate ways around the fact that the iPad digitizer is not very high resolution and requires, you know, a kind of fat, meaty finger going down on the screen in order for it to sense a touch. So it's kind of like, do you remember in the early days when they didn't ship was it the original Mac or was it the Apple II? I can't remember. I think probably the Mac shipped with a mouse and didn't have arrow keys on the keyboard, so that developers would not continue to depend on there being arrow keys on the keyboard for navigation.
Did not know that.
Yeah, and that was it's the same kind of argument again. I think that they should not ship a stylus so that people don't start designing screens or designing apps that assume there's going to be a stylus, right? Because iOS is not a stylus-driven OS, and I don't think it should become one. But there are times and places when people absolutely want to use a stylus. And I think if the hardware supported it a bit better, then that experience could be a lot better for those people who want to use it.
Well, and certainly as the iPad is no longer just a consumer tool. I mean, it's something the doctors use, architects can use, engineers can use, teachers use, and different verticals need different tools. And again, going back to, you probably shouldn't ship a stylus with it, but it's supporting a stylus. There's no reason, just because Apple doesn't ship something with the Mac doesn't mean it doesn't support it. They don't support like those Wacom tablets, or they don't build them. They don't ship them with it, but it supports it.
Yep.
And to me, that's one of those things that would help iOS get more on par with the Mac OS, and you continue that drive towards being able to do more and more of your power level features directly on iOS.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I'm kind of pro on that, even though I don't personally like to write on the iPad. Perhaps I would like it more if it was higher resolution and more sensitive. But I think, particularly in light of our discussion about interactive whiteboards, there's a lot of people in education as well who want to write on a digital device in order to have that same experience as they've had on the blackboard, the whiteboard, and then the interactive whiteboard over the years as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so my last request for the new iPad is that the casing is different. And I don't just mean from a visual point of view, but there's a couple of things I would like them to change about it. And one is very personal, which is that I have really dry hands, and the aluminium back of the iPad is like ice in my hands. it is so unbelievably lacking in grip for my skin that I would love it to have some kind of rubber coating or something on the back. Now, I'm pretty sure Apple's not going to put a rubber coating on it, but just something that's not polished aluminium would be really, really nice. But also, I think there's another thing that is the design of the iPad 2 and later is very, very vulnerable to drops on the corner because of the sort of tapered edge design of the case. If you manage to land it right on a corner, there's a tiny sliver of case takes all the force of the drop. And I think if it could be a little more perhaps rounded, maybe not come to quite so fine a point on the edges, like the iPad Mini does, I suppose, then it could just be a good bit more drop-proof. And, of course, everybody wants a second chance when they drop the device. So I think that would be nice to have, just something that was a bit more drop-proof.
Martha Stewart would appreciate that.
I hate that I know what you're referring to there, but I do.
If you don't know, like, she was on Twitter and was complaining that her iPod, or she dropped her iPad and it broke and didn't know if Apple was supposed to come pick it up or what. And I think like the Apple's PR team maybe reached out to her and said, hey, please stop. And she said, she went on back on Twitter and said that Steve gave me this iPad. It's like, what are you supposed to do with that? Like, so they're supposed to cover it forever? I don't know.
Yeah, and it's probably some old thing like an iPad 2 as well.
Oh, I'm sure. At minimum. I mean, maybe an iPad 1.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
This one was touched by Steve.
Yes.
Okay. You want to do some feedback?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to tell us about Jam first?
Oh, yeah. We got their sponsor. Yeah.
Don't forget those guys.
All right. So I want to thank our friends at Jamf for sponsoring the show this week. Jamf Software provides ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology, such as Macs, iPhones, iPads, and Apple TVs and education organizations. Now, one thing that's awesome about Jamf is they support Apple, number one. So it's not one of these, they don't treat Apple as a second-tier platform that is the number one focus. Now, with Casper Focus, they have placed these powerful technologies directly in the hands of the teachers that work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain their students' attentions, conduct secure exams within an app, select an Apple TV that's assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. So if you're needing to learn more about MDM solutions and with Apple devices, make sure you check out jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com, and we'll have a link to them in the show notes.
Yes, indeed. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show so many times.
Yes. So a couple of feedback we'll run through before we call it a night. First one is from Alex Chan, a friend of the show. Mm-hmm. I won't read the entire question. It was basically wanting to know about upgrade process for iOS 7. And of course, we talked about that on the last show, but you know, he's more asking, when are you planning to update? December and Christmas seems like a natural time, but I'm curious if there are any other factors that might influence your decision. Especially since this release seems to contain a lot of goodies for education, which I imagine you might are keen to deploy. Big fan of the show. I really enjoy listening every week. Although I don't work in education myself, I find it really interesting. Thanks for the email, Alex. And so as we mentioned in the last show, you know, you and I both have really kind of gone to this pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think, I guess at the end of the day, it goes back to we just didn't have a lot of changes in the core functionality of iOS. And even though the interface changes, again, you know, iOS is so ingrained in our culture at this point that just wasn't a big deal. I mean, even like a lot of regular people I know had already upgraded to iOS 7 and knew about iOS 7 ahead of time and knew what date it was coming out.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think also kids who maybe have their own iPod Touch or something at home, they'd already got it at home, so they knew it. They were telling me about how they'd upgraded their own devices and in some cases their parents' devices as well. And there was a lot of anticipation for it. I mean, a lot of kids were really excited to get it. It was actually really funny. My daughter, who comes to the school, she was very, very upset one day going home in the car. She was crying and I said, April, what's wrong? And she said, I'm so upset because two of my friends say they don't like iOS 7. I was like, I think they just do that to upset you. Don't worry about it. They said they don't want to upgrade to iOS 7. I was like, April, it's not that big a deal. Just, you know, everybody's getting upgraded in time, so just relax.
Yeah, they'll have to come along whether they like it or not.
Yeah, they get on the train. It's really interesting, though, because I made a big song and dance to my kids about, please don't just hit the button on the first day. Let me take a day or two just to make sure there's no showstoppers, and then we'll all go for it. And having said that, when 7.02 came out, I was looking at my Casper thing and I realized that, you know, a lot of kids had gone to 7 but not to 7.02, and I was kind of wondering why. And then a boy came in to talk to me today and said, look, I know you said to wait before we upgrade stuff. When can we put in iOS 7.02? And I was like, well, you can just go ahead and do that one. I mean, iOS 7's the big jump, but, you know, the point updates, you won't see any difference. He's like, all right. I didn't think we could just go ahead and do that. So I need to get that message out to kids as well. But I think it's also, I guess, in our favor a little bit, Bradley, that we're not updating like 600 iPads.
Yes.
You know, I think if I was doing that, A, I would be a lot more conservative about when I did it. And also I would want to make sure that I wasn't jumping on something that was really buggy to start with, because that's a big operation. And if you're doing that, then you're going to, you don't want to have to redo it or try and roll it back if you can, which of course Apple shut the door on very quickly because they stopped selling iOS 6 within, I think, like 3 days of iOS 7 coming out, which was really, yes, really aggressive this time around. So if I was doing a big number, I would probably be doing that in a more staged fashion, starting with maybe 1 year group or 2 year groups and doing it over a defined period of time. Having said that, one of the other things, I mean, if you're doing a personal model, there's nothing you can do to stop people upgrading anyway. There's no control you can put in place, particularly if they take them off your network, in which case they can get it anywhere at any time. So that was part of my thinking around the whole thing was, well, it's going to happen anyway. There's nothing I can do to stop it. So I might as well get out ahead of it and sort of try and manage the process a little bit rather than just it happening randomly, you know, over the course of months in the school. So that was part of my thinking as well.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, when you've got bigger deployments, you've got kind of more at stake. And there's also, when you get to bigger deployments, you've got kind of a wider range of people, maybe some even more less and less technical people that have no idea what even iOS even is. And so you kind of got to do it slowly. You've got more at stake with a bigger deployment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I suppose it also depends a little bit on, you know, are there critical applications, you know, and I was running the GM of iOS 7 for about a week before other people. So I was able to at least figure out, well, there's not really a showstopper with Keynote or Pages, and Shobi was okay. Google Drive was okay, you know. So I felt that our major applications were fine. Some of the minor applications had small glitches that got fixed. But of course, because of the auto update in iOS 7, those got fixed and they rolled out pretty quickly, so there wasn't a huge problem with that.
Yeah. Think about how a healthcare organization, imagine they have a custom built application. You know, they've really got to be careful.
Yeah, I think that's where you get into a very careful situation, is where you have some kind of B2B application or something that basically that's why you've got your devices. And if that doesn't work, you're not moving your OS to anything until that application is ready for you.
Yeah. So you want to take the next question?
Yeah, so the next question comes from Arlen Nagata, who asks, he says, if I don't have a computer science background, where do you suggest I go to learn how to deploy and manage an enterprise network at a small school, which is three-story buildings? So that's his question. How would you come against that one, Bradley?
Well, you know, I don't have a computer science background either. I've got a management degree. I just really learned by doing. I learned by tinkering around the interfaces. And, you know, when I came to my school, you know, I was an Apple specialist as much as anything, and I picked up all the LAN and wireless stuff along the way. You know, personally, I learned best by doing. Of course, there's obviously a ton of classes you can take and various certifications. So if your school is going to be a Sonic Wall school, then you might want to go take a Sonic Wall class. If you're going to be an Aerohive school, go and take some of their specific training. Biggest thing too is you want to find good partners. Find a vendor who will sell it and install it for you, but also attempt to teach you along the way. So if something breaks in the future, you don't have to call them for every little thing. Like maybe you can kind of get some pointers along the way.
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing about vendor certification is that you can very quickly end up in a situation where you or your technical staff only want to use that vendor's products because those are the ones they're certified on. And if you make certification the thing that justifies your technology purchase, then you can end up in some funny backwaters at times. To be honest with you, it's one thing that I wish Apple would do a little bit more of is like some kind of certification for iOS deployment. I think that's a really, really big hole in Apple's kind of program offerings right now, is that a lot of sysadmins who are used to being certified in the things that they deploy, it gives them a lot of confidence as well, are being asked to put out iOS devices, and there's essentially nothing they can go to except phoning me up or phoning up somebody locally that they know, to try and figure out what are the pitfalls of iOS deployment. So I think that's something that Apple could build one of. That would be really nice if they had that.
Well, I agree. They've got an iOS qualification, but that's more of like you understand how to use iOS and also like you know how to spot what's an in-warranty repair and out-of-warranty repair, but that's nothing about the deployment side.
It's very much from the kind of hardware side of things, isn't it?
Yeah, it's meant for like an authorized Apple retailer to decide like, okay, Apple's going to fix this or Apple's not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do have a computer science background. My first degree is software engineering. But you know what's really weird about having a computer science background is you don't always know a lot about networking. It's really weird. Most of my degree, Glasgow University, 96 to 2000, was actually tons and tons and tons of programming. And like one course on networking, or maybe two, if I remember rightly. So even you know, coming into the job, my first job was deploying computer clusters for the Large Hadron Collider project, the grid computing project. And that's actually where I learned all my networking stuff and my sysadmin stuff, was on that job. Heck of a first job out of university, but it taught me a lot. And some of it very exotic as well, you know, 10 gigabit per second networking and so on. But that was kind of, it seems weird to say that, like, you know, I worked on the grid computing for a big physics project and then I came to a school and did iPads. But a lot of what I learned there has had very direct and sometimes indirect application to what I do here as well. So that was good background for me too.
It's just, I think we've just learned, you know, there's no degree that's going to prepare you for every aspect of your job. You're going to always have to learn on the job a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, the key thing to me is the principles, right? I find myself getting really frustrated when people say, oh, everything changes so fast, as if the whole thing is being reinvented every year, which is not true. I mean, the surface presentation of these things is being reinvented all the time. I mean, there's new social messaging apps every day. There's new social networks. There's new this and that and the next thing. But, you know, they're still all running over the internet. And is the internet fundamentally changing? Well, I mean, look how long it's taken us to get to IPv6. Right, that's a fundamental change. And that, you know, in some ways, the internet's actually not moving fast enough for some of that stuff. You know, and I think when you know the fundamentals, you've got a very solid base to work on. Okay. Now, obviously, new things come along. We talked about 802.11ac in the last show. But do you have to completely learn that from scratch? No. Right. Many of these things are modifications to what has come before. We just talked about what might be in the new iPad. Well, okay, that's a new iPad, but it's not a complete first principles reinvention of tablet computers, right? It'll be the thing you know right now, plus a bit more on top, okay? So I think the important thing is to understand that there are things that don't change very much, and there are frothy things on top that change every 6 weeks. And the key thing is to focus on the bits that aren't going to change that quickly. But bear in mind that they might actually change one day.
Yes. Well, it's just business principles change, but the fundamentals of business are still true. I mean, there are different marketing strategies. I mean, obviously, when someone went to school for marketing 10 years ago, there weren't classes on social media, but you know, you can pick that up. Like it's an extension of the core.
Yeah, yeah. Although the fundamentals of business, where you actually make something and charge people money for it, seem to have been forgotten in recent years.
True. Somebody's got to pay the bill. I don't know.
Yeah. Somebody always pays.
Last question. I'm a lead genius at an Apple store. I'm not in education, but as you can imagine, I meet lots of people in education. I'm in the process of learning everything about iOS deployments to better serve our business education customers. Your podcast has been a wealth of information. Sincerely, Tim Cook. Oh, wait, I shouldn't have read his name. Sorry. Just kidding.
Yeah, he knows everything.
Yeah, I hear you speak a lot about Aerohive. I would love if you would do a show around why Aerohive. Why is it different than other systems, and why Aerohive in education? So, you know, obviously you and I have both been Aerohive customers for a while. I've been an Aerohive customer since early 2012. So, and now they called me, and I didn't find them. They called me and introduced their solution to me. And we were looking for a new wireless network at the time. And for me, a light bulb just went off about it. It just, to me, it was light years ahead of anything else. And so I'll explain, I guess, kind of the fundamentally why I love Aerohive's, you know, architecture and why I love, you know, their products. So I'll start off with talking about there are three planes of a Wi-Fi network. So you've got the control plane that handles things like RF optimization, power levels, you know, the roaming, things like that. Then you've got the management plane, which is how the AP receives changes, you know, new configurations.
And that can be things like the SSID setup, usernames and passwords, VLAN configurations, things like that?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And then the data plane, so like how the actual data is getting out to the internet.
Okay.
So Aerohive basically changed all of that. You know, typically in a controller-based solution, like that's like a Ruckus or an Aruba, you know, in the early days, everything funneled through the controller. So if you can imagine imagine if all your switches had a master switch. That's what a controller is. And so all three planes went back through the controller. Now, in recent years, you know, the controller vendors have moved the data plane out, and that's kind of going straight out to the internet. For obvious reasons, that's just a huge bottleneck. But really, even the control plane is becoming a bottleneck. As you add, high density, you know, deployments, all these things are just, when they're having to have a, you know, kind of a single point to go through, that's just a big bottleneck.
So if I understand you right about controllers, you could make a comparison to a mainframe and dumb terminal kind of model.
Yes.
Where all the
yes.
brains are in one big box somewhere on your network, and essentially the access points that are on the ceilings are kind of dumb boxes of radio.
Yeah,
like rather than having any real processing capability in the box.
Right, and so you have thin AP versus, like with Aerohive, they call them, you know, more fat APs, because they, you know, with Aerohive, everything's happening directly on the AP. Okay. And the reason we had controllers back in the early days of enterprise wireless is just we couldn't fit a processor fast enough in the AP to do it. You had to have a controller.
Okay.
But we've just moved past that point. You know, and so
there are two different types of kind of non, you know, on-site controller markets. You've got cloud controlled and cloud managed. So you don't have a kind of a physical device in your office. Now, the probably the most well-known cloud controlled is Meraki. They're owned by Cisco. And so their control plane is in the cloud. So like your RF up, you know, your RF optimization, your power levels, all of, you know, your roaming information, that's actually handled through their data center. And so if your internet hiccups or their data center hiccups, so does your control plane.
So I think one of the things to point out there is that roaming is actually quite an important thing. RF optimization, power levels, those are things you might change from time to time. But roaming is obviously, as people move around your facility, that's going to be happening a lot more. Am I right with that?
Yeah. And well, I guess I probably should look up. I'm almost 99% sure Meraki hasn't built something else into it. That would be the only thing is if they built something different with their control plane. Okay. But yeah, typically, yes, I'll check into that and verify. Mm-hmm. But you know, for example, your captive web portal from Meraki is if it's handled from their data center. So if you have a guest network with a captive web portal and their network goes down, not just your network, but their network, your captive web portals go down.
Okay.
So then you've got a cloud managed network. So, and that's what Aerohive has built. So they have a centralized, you know, system to manage these, and you can either run this, they can either host it for you or you can either run it in your office, but it's managed, not controlled. So it's mainly there to, you know, kind of gather information and push out new changes. So if you have a captive web portal on an Aerohive access point, it's handled directly on the AP. Your RF optimization and your power levels are handled directly on the AP. So all the APs can sense each other. So there's no kind of central authority that's controlling everything. It's directly on the AP. So it's really built like the internet's built. You know, even though Meraki doesn't have a physical on-site controller, they've got an off-site controller, basically. And so if that goes down, you're down. With Aerohive, even if their data center blows up or if your on-site system blows up, your APs are not affected. The only thing you couldn't do would be push out new changes. But all the actual work is handled directly at the edge, which, again, is how it should be. I mean, that's just how we built the internet.
That's the internet architecture, isn't it? Brains at the edge of the network. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what they built. So they've got these, every AP has a built-in firewall. All the captive web portals served out directly from the AP. All the roaming is handled directly by the APs. So there's no single point of failure. The only way to take down an Aerohive network is to actually pull the plug on the power.
Okay. So a power cut in the building will kill it, but
yeah,
everything else. Yeah.
Controllers are bad. They don't need to exist anymore. You know, if the architecture was good, we would do that for our switches, and we don't. And they're expensive, and they require backups.
Yeah, it's like it's another server, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one other thing about controllers, right? Let me just help me understand if I'm right about my understanding here. But let's say you want to grow your wireless network. My understanding, your controller is obviously fixed in its capacity. It has a certain kind of processing capability, it has a certain network capacity. If I have 10 access points being run from that controller, each one has access to 1/10 of the power of that controller, let's say.
Yes.
If I then put another 10 access points on my network, I have cut into the capacity of the controller, you know, so everyone is now getting 1/20 instead of 1/10. Right. So if I need to grow my network with extra access points, then my controller will eventually have to be either duplicated or increased in size in order to cope with that expansion. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, but in a model like Aerohive's, to add an access point to your network is to add additional processing capacity to your network. So the growth argument is much more in favor of the intelligence being in the access point rather than being in the controller, yeah?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, it's like almost as you add access points, it gets stronger.
Yeah.
Where instead the controller-based model, it becomes more of a bottleneck.
Yeah. So eventually you're going to need to buy a second controller or a much bigger one. And I mean, I've never seen a price list for these Wi-Fi controllers, but I suspect, given the names of the companies that sell them, they're not less than the cost of my car.
The companies that sell them will kill you on feature licensing as well. Mm. There's a big difference between like selling additional products and feature licensing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of like companies like, the Arubas, the Tiscos, they'll feature license you to death. And to clarify, I was wrong about the roaming. I found an article on Meraki's website. The roaming is not interrupted. So just that's a correction earlier. Okay. So their control plane is not interrupted. But still, you're still depending on their cloud for some of your core networking capabilities. But roaming can still happen.
So I think maybe one of the things to say about that is possibly that it depends very much on what you do with your Wi-Fi network, whether that's a problem for you.
Yes.
Because I'm thinking, like, for us, if our internet connection to Meraki's cloud goes down, then, well, what else are we doing with our network except going on the internet? So to us, that's probably the same failure mode. But if you were doing a lot of internal traffic, then that would be a catastrophic problem for your network. You know, so if you were doing, iPads in the organization talking to internal servers, you would want that to survive even an interruption of your internet. But for us, I don't know that that would necessarily cause us any more of a problem than the fact that the internet was down in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So controllers, they're just, to me, I just would never think about putting a controller-based solution in our office. There's just no shot.
Yeah.
Next section is, why does Aerohive work well with Apple products? So, from a business standpoint, they're easy for schools to understand. It's simple pricing and it's simple deployment. You don't have all these feature licensing. You don't have to like kind of plan out your controller ahead of time. If you want to start small, you can do that and you don't have to worry about outgrowing the controller. So it's kind of a simple bill of materials. It's easy to understand. They can say, look, we need 30 access points. Okay, we're going to buy 30 access points and 30 licenses for support, basically for extended warranties for APs. That's it. There's no other features to buy. Aerohive also, and I will have a link to a YouTube video, they have focused on improving their sensitivity and their APs on the receive side. So they're actually specifically for iPads. So they're saying, look, we know a lot of our customers use iPads, so we're going to do what we can to make what the iPad has work better. Mm-hmm. So, and then they also built the Bonjour Gateway as well. So they're really focused on Apple customers, just like, our sponsor Jamf, they're focused on Apple customers.
Yeah, the Bonjour Gateway is, is the first iteration of software products that solve that problem that we mentioned earlier about Apple TV's Bonjour traffic going across subnets. I haven't deployed it fully in our school yet. I've tried it a couple of times and had a couple of glitches, but I haven't tried it since Hive Manager 6 came out. So in the latest firmware, I think it could be a bit better.
Yeah, and I know that it can get more and more complicated as you have more and more Apple TVs, more and more printers, and more VLANs. Can get trickier. And of course, we talked about Aerohive's management system earlier, and it's called Hive Manager, and it's an out-of-band system. So, it doesn't control anything. You can literally have five APs or tens of thousands in one interface, and you can push out changes to all of them in one time. It's kind of a single pane of glass to see into your entire network. And, but it's out of band. So nothing, if that thing blows up, if you can't access it, nothing on your network is affected. Everything is served at the edge. So you don't have a single point of failure where, again, with Meraki, you have it with, obviously with Aruba and Cisco and Ruckus. If the controller goes down, you're out of luck.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that I have used in the past and will be turning on again soon is a nice feature of the Hive Manager or the Aerohive firmware, which is integration with Casper. I think they're also integrated with AirWatch MDM as well now. But yes. Basically, in both cases, what you can do is when a device associates to the network, you can. I think we mentioned this when we were talking about LA and their problems with kids taking off MDM profiles. If the device is not enrolled with your Casper server or your AirWatch server, then it will be denied access to the internet. And that's not a feature of Casper. Somebody emailed me to ask me that question for clarification. That's not a feature of Casper. That's a feature of Aerohive. And Casper's only saying yes or no to Aerohive's query, is this device enrolled or not? But it's actually the Aerohive system that does that kind of smart questioning of the enrollment status of the device before they let them have access to the internet.
That's a yeah, pretty it's cool just, feature. Well, again, education is one of their big focuses, and so they do things that are trying to make our lives easier. And things like we talked about in the last show, you can drop in an AC access point and not have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about like making sure your controller can handle it, or when they release a new firmware, you can upgrade one AP at a time if you want to. If you want to test it, with a Cisco solution, it's kind of an all or none. All of the APs have to go. One of the things that a lot of people don't know about Aerohive, which I really appreciate, is all their products are running a single code base. It's called HiveOS. So like their switches, which, we didn't talk about that, but they offer switches as well. Their branch routers and their access points are all running the same code base. So it's not like they've just basically gone and paid a company to build products for them and write code. They're doing that themselves. And so long term, that allows them to be more flexible and more nimble, because they kind of have that infrastructure in place and they're not trying to patch stuff together, 5 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been very happy with the Aerohive system. It's now, we obviously redesigned our SSID structure this year for the new deployment. We didn't talk about private pre-shared key. I think that's not necessarily a unique Aerohive feature anymore, but it has been very useful for us, the idea that every user can have their own password for the network, and then that identifies the traffic that comes from the device that presents that password. So we have, for our teachers, they can use their password four times on four different devices. For the kids, they just get to use it one time on their own personal school, or their own school iPad, if you like. And that's been really useful for us, because what it means is that in our Hive Manager system, I can look at the traffic and I can actually see who's doing what traffic in terms of how much bandwidth they're sending to iTunes or YouTube or wherever. It can break that down for me and have a look at it, which is really cool.
Yeah, and this is like in place of having to do something like 802.1x authentication. It's like a simplified thing that you can do directly, within Aerohive system. It's doesn't cost anything. It's just free.
Yeah, I mean, basically what I did was I created a CSV file for all our kids, just uploaded that into Hive Manager, and then of course you push it out to the access points, because that's where all the brains live, and then you restart the network and you're good to go. Speaking of restarting the network, another really nice feature of the fact that it's out of band is that what you can do is you can set up some changes in the network, and then you can schedule the change to happen at a later time, which is of course really useful for school, because you don't want to disrupt the network during the school day. But then you can say, upload this new configuration and then activate it at 5 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night or whatever, and then it's ready for the next day, which is a nice feature too.
Well, what I'll do is I call it like the Wi-Fi game, whereas I'll do that. I'll set it to upload at midnight or to reboot at midnight with the changes. Mm-hmm. And then I'll watch our clients on the APs, and when one hits zero, I'll restart it in the middle of the day. Because if somebody goes to recess or to lunch or something, I'll restart that access point, and it all just still works fine.
Yeah.
And so, there are a lot of times when I've got 95% of the access points, on the latest either firmware or change by the end of the day. I don't know why I do that, but it's just fun.
Yeah, that can be it's good to be able to do that kind of thing, get that kind of insight. I mean, this isn't an Aerohive exclusive feature, but just the difference for me, having come from a Wi-Fi network based on Apple Airport Extreme base stations that I was managing individually, versus having some kind of enterprise grade system, is night and day. And I think our Apple network worked fine. Don't get me wrong; it worked perfectly well for a good number of years and survived our transition to 1-to-1 as well. But what I can do now with Wi-Fi compared to what I could do then, it's just like having superpowers. It's fantastic, and I've been delighted with it, and I think it's been a really great transition for us too.
Well, and you're right. It's it's simple. It just works. It's easy to deploy. You don't have to be like a wireless nerd to be able to deploy it. And they were really the pioneer in the controllerless and cloud-enabled networking market. And obviously, I'm big fans of Aerohive, but it's not because They paid me. I'm a big fan of them because I like their products and they work well for us. We've been thrilled with them in our office, and we've continued to, as we've needed to, add on access points. We just buy them and plug them in, and they show up in our Hive Manager, and we push out a firmware, push out the configuration, and you're good to go. So I guess, like, if you know, you want the, like, the too long didn't read version of this, is it's simple. It just works. There's no single point of failure. I don't ever have a situation where I have to say, like, our Wi-Fi is down. I mean, like, if our Wi-Fi is down, our whole network is down, our LAN is down, you know, there's something major wrong, because yeah. There's no single point of failure. It, you know, if a switch goes down, you know, and the AP, like, let's say, for example, I have a switch that goes down on one part of the building on the lower level. Well, the users will roam to maybe a AP that's farther away, but that actually has a live connection to the internet. I mean, that's the kind of things they can do, because, again, there's no single point of failure. We've been happy. I can't say that enough. We've just been happy with their products.
Yeah. It's good to have these. It's good to have good products in your life.
Yes. Yes.
Always important.
So I hope that answered your question, Mr. Tim Cook. But not really. But no, it's just they're great products. I mean, again, I'm not saying that other wireless vendors are terrible. They're obviously, they all, you know, make fine products, and they all have customers, and their customers are happy with them. Mm-hmm. But just for me and for my school, we love Aerohive.
Would you say, here's a question for you, just off the cuff. I don't want to put you on the spot, but are there other situations where you would go with other Wi-Fi vendors? I'm thinking particularly of situations. I came across a situation where somebody asked me recently they wanted to put Wi-Fi all over their sports facility, which included a lot of outdoor stuff. I know Aerohive make an outdoor AP, but are there other companies that maybe do a better job with that, or a more comprehensive job?
Yeah, you know, like, let's say like a stadium. Yeah. You know, Xeris, you know, makes, they make, like, have an array product. They work well in that, where they can cram a bunch of APs in a you know, like, in a short kind of area, and you shoot it out. And so they make some nice products. Obviously, Aerohive would work there. It might take a little bit more tinkering, because, again, going back to that, you know, channel issue, if you had, you know, 1,000 outdoor access points, you might have to lower the power level to not have co-channel interference. But yeah, Xeris makes nice products, particularly for those outdoor environments.
Yeah. So the super, super high density applications. Yes. Yeah,
like, again, like an NFL stadium or a Major League Soccer stadium.
Okay, you're talking about quite a lot of devices in one place at one time.
Very, you don't want to manage that network.
Relatively. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay, so shall we wrap it up there?
Yeah, for just, I think now? So.
I can't even begin to remember what day this show is going out, but I think the show will be out before the iPad announcement.
Yes, yeah, so it should be out the day before.
We're recording this essentially a week ahead of time, so this show will go out before then, and then we'll catch up after that.
All right, sounds good.
After I've ordered whatever it is they produce, I don't care what it is, I'm definitely ordering it.
Well, do you want to run through where people can find us around the internet?
Okay, so for me, spears.org is my blog, SPEIRS.org. Fraser Spears on Twitter.
And I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter, and Chambers Daily on the web.
Okay, so let's wrap it up there, and we'll catch you on the other side of new iPads.
Have a good week, everybody.